ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing Ken Doctor, a veteran of the digital media industry. He's the father of the word newsonomics, which he coined to describe the new discipline of understanding the money flow within the print and broadcast transition to digital. In addition to writing the book Newsonomics, 12 New Trends That Will Shape the News You Get, he also writes the popular Newsonomics column for the Nieman Journalism Lab and writes regularly for political media as well. As a speaker and consultant, he works with media globally, advising on new sustainable business models of contemporary journalism. Ken, thank you so much for joining us today. You have an interesting perspective on the disruption in media because it's really the sort of heart of what you're looking at Newsonomics. It started with print, but you look at the whole media landscape, right?
Right. Yeah, I started because I came out of the newspaper industry and I started there. And then, yeah, it's been 11 years now that I've been on my own as an independent. And as I started doing the work, really the business of newspapering, it became quite clear that in the digital disruption, it didn't really matter if you started as a publisher or as a broadcaster. Or as a public radio station, and even to some degree, if you started as a digital media startup, that the same kind of rules apply. And of course, legacy companies have different kinds of challenges and opportunities. But media basically blended as we moved into the digital business world.
Right. For years, they had always been talking about convergence. I remember back in the early 90s, people talking about, oh, it's going to be telecommunications, entertainment, yeah, and it's all going to converge. And then it didn't, and it didn't, and it didn't. And then it felt like all of a sudden it did. And people somehow, despite knowing it was coming, were caught a bit flat-footed. And I guess things continue to be disrupted and continue to change in ways that we don't necessarily anticipate.
Yeah, and the convergence idea is a really interesting idea, and you're right. It is one of those words that that has hung on for a long time and went as you described it. Yet there are different kinds of convergence, and I think that's an interesting point right now, that we have a convergence of business models. So basically, in the digital world, business models apply to everybody. But in terms of convergence of product, which is one of the things that we've long talked about, of how newspaper companies wouldn't be newspaper companies. They would have a lot of video, and that TV stations would learn how to do text, and that these would become indistinguishable. Amazingly, in 2017, it hasn't happened. Now we see, New York Times doing more video, and other print legacy ones doing it, and we see more text coming out of operations from NBC News Digital to this regional broadcast. But these, we do not really have a good model of convergence. And this is at least 20 years into the internet.
Right. Well, and also I think that you have players that you didn't necessarily think of as coming to the party, like companies like tech companies like Facebook, who's clinging to its tech definition by this, grasping to say it's a tech company, right, not a media company. Please, please. But backing up before, because I do want to actually talk about that a little farther down the line.
Sure.
First, I wanted, your website mentions a focus on small data versus big data. And
yeah,
I wanted to know if you could speak a little bit about the differences between the two types of data and why the corporate love affair with big data, because that's sort of everybody is just swooning about big data, might be missing the forest for the trees a little bit.
I always think of big data as when you're walking through the airports and the billboards in the airports are always scaring you about big data. And they're obviously aimed at business people and saying, there's a lot of stuff you don't know. You better know it. And if you don't buy our product that's going to help you harness the usually menacing figure of big data, it's going to be a big problem. So it's a fear sell. Big data just sounds overwhelming. Clearly, there is so much data. None of us can imagine how much there is in any sphere or total, like several universes or endless universes. So it is not an empowering concept. Big data is a fear concept, I think, which has been successfully used to sell corporate solutions. Mm-hmm. Little data is a very simple idea. And it really goes back to how do you run your business? And in the case of a publishing business or a media business, what is it you're trying to do? What kind of audience are you trying to engage? And what do you know then about their engagement? So you might have your aim, whatever it is, to essentially rent movies or to sell news or music or whatever. But what do you really want to know about the actual use and engagement of your customers, both of your products and of your digital experience, both on the smartphone and on the web? And so small data is the ability of really business people to ask smart questions and say, I wonder if that reader is reading. After they read all those politics stories, do they just read politics or do they go on to read other stories on our site? Or what other sites do they go on to? And then, importantly, what patterns do we see? So small data is empowering. And I see very hopeful signs the last 2-3 years of some of the bigger companies coming around to that idea.
So it seems like it's both some of it has to do with their marketing and their positioning. It's scary. That's the sell. But also it's about the operationalizing what you're getting. Yeah. And so
absolutely,
making
yeah.
it functional and immediately useful to the individual. I almost think like, if big data is the fortress wall, the small data is the chainmail that the individual soldier might wear, right? So it's more flexible, it's smaller, because it isn't as big a picture, or is it? I mean, is small data culled from big data, or is small data just smaller data sets that are coming from, that are easier to achieve? You don't need sort of these high-powered programs or people to do it, or sort of what's the on the ground thing that you're getting? How is it different?
So it's the combination of two things. It is, of course, it's combing that haystack, right, of big data. Another cliched word, fire hose, right? That fire hose of data keeps on coming 24/7, and this keeps mounting up and mounting up. So it's in there. But there are questions in there. And as I talked to companies and I pointed to the Financial Times that I first visited in 2009. And in 2009, I talked to Rob Grimshaw, who was then the managing director of the FT. And he has since left the company. But it was in his office, and a sales guy, but one of the more reserved sales guys I had seen. And I said, so, Rob, what's your model? What's your model of publishing? You guys are obviously smart. And what do you look to in the publishing world? And he paused for about 20 seconds, which is a long time.
Right.
And then he said, well, we looked around and we couldn't find anybody. And he said, kind of sounded apologetic about it, that he couldn't point to any good examples in his own industry. And he said, but then we looked at Amazon. And what we want to be is we want to be the Amazon of publishing. And amazingly, the FT has become that. And that phrase actually motivated them to change their company. So as a picture that to answer that on the ground question, what they did is they moved in now, 8 years to having a team. They had a research team of 9 people who did PowerPoints for their salespeople. The salespeople come in and say, tell me that we really have a lot of people who buy these ridiculously expensive watches. And they go, okay, we'll do it for you. They got rid of that team. And today, fast forward, they have more than 40 people in data science at the FT. And those are embedded. They are a separate department, and they're embedded both in the newsroom and in the sales department. So that the salespeople can ask the data people questions on the fly, and the editorial people are asking them questions about how are people reading, where are they reading, how far are they scrolling down in stories. They know their conversion metrics. What kinds of stories lead to actual sales of subscriptions, which is just about the whole ballgame now for high-end news publishers. So it's that combination of business people who feel like, yeah, there's some answers in that data, but they figure out what they want to know. I want to sell subscriptions. How can I better sell subscriptions? How do I optimize that process? And interestingly, it's just working its way into the newsrooms at this point. I was just at the Washington Post last month. Same thing, where the editors are actually looking at the scroll length and the scroll depth of their stories to try to understand what people are reading and what they're not.
Well, that's a perfect segue into my next question. It's like you knew it was coming. And that's about the data-driving content algorithms. Mashable has their velocity algorithm that they use because they know how content spreads and how it's shared. And that's starting to drive, you know, the desire to write viral content and shareable content. But what does that mean from a news standpoint? Because sometimes people don't want to share something, but they really need to know it. So is that changing the content? And what is that sort of, are there societal implications to that or not?
I think it's one of these many tools. One of the things that I was thinking about and I wrote in a couple of year-end pieces is, especially with the Trump election, the tools of technology, which I would bet all the people listening to this podcast use greatly, and we all enjoy them, have proven to be neutral. They're not the most wonderful things. They're not going to necessarily make the world a better place unto themselves. It's all in the hands of the users of those, and we've seen the cynical manipulation of those tools. Sadly, in this election, in the case of machine learning, really, of figuring out to be able to do predictive analysis of these people like this kind of stuff, or this person likes this kind of stuff, we're going to give them more of this. We know a shareability index. All of these are great tools, but they're only tools. And so this age of machine learning is now kicking in. My technology friends in publishing tell me in that in 12 to 18 months, we're going to see much more passive personalization. Hmm. And each one of them has said the same thing, which is we're going to be very, very careful with it, that we understand that people don't want a wholly programmed experience. But we want to be able to show them more of what we think they want without excluding news that we think is important. Right. I think that's where the judgment comes in. And that's the difference in news publishing, where you're saying not just what's most popular, clearly what Google and Facebook care about, but what's also important, and the judgment in our society to balance the two.
Right. Well, so one of the things I wanted to now segue into is we're in this post-truth world. And so obviously I can't not ask about your thoughts on fake news and also outlets like Facebook, where, you know, you had in one of your year-end lists, which I loved a comment you made about how they said 99% of what they did was good. But that meant that 1% was, you know, first of all, who's like, yeah, 1% is completely wrong, which is astounding. And that also, because of the volume of material, that meant that 50 million bits of misinformation were being pumped out daily, which is astronomical. So is Facebook a media company?
Well, I think of it, it's really, when we step back from this, and I live on the edge of Silicon Valley and I worked at it, it's an advertising company. And Google is an advertising company. So let's not be so high toned about this. Silicon Valley on HBO is a realistic depiction of a lot of the personalities in the Valley. Now, there are brilliant people at both of those companies, and they are good minded people. And they were horrified at some of the ways they abetted bad actors in the election. But these are advertising companies. Both of them make more than 90%, probably more than 95% of their revenue from advertising. And their domination of digital advertising, which will become the number one ad type in the country in 2017, is a huge problem unto itself, which I don't know if we'll have time to get into. But in terms of that, they're advertising companies. Of course, they're media companies because They're mediators. They are the new mass media, just like newspapers and TV used to be. But they don't want to take responsibility for being a media company. And the law, as we set it up 20 years ago, allows them to evade responsibility. So it's a knotty question, and it's not just a matter of repealing, say, a DMCA to make them culpable, but we need a reckoning. We need really, without politics, which seems impossible at this point, of how do we deal with the digital disruption intelligently in our time? And I'd love to see that discussion, but we seem to be getting farther away from it rather than closer.
Well, one of the things, it was interesting, I spoke with Mike Sheehan, CEO of the Boston Globe, and it was, he was really quite moving on the topic of hard journalistic news and newspapers and how they were necessary sort of for the proper functioning of democracy, to that they needed a force paying attention and holding people accountable in a way that people trusted. And certainly the integrity factor seems, you know, when you have things, when people are consuming things, especially your digital natives who are growing up, you know, you used to be able to look at a newspaper and you could see how it was printed and the layout. But if everything is fed through the same digital feed and all the typefaces are the same and all of the images are the same, it's harder. The signals, the cues that say, well, this might be squirrely, aren't necessarily there. And so it becomes challenging and disrupting in a societal way, you know, not just a business model way. And
It's clearly already happened. It's been happening, and it's not like we've been blind to it. But what this election has done is had the impact of a crashing reality, that all of what you just described, of the old signals being gone or far less used, and the new signals not yet being created.
Yes.
Because that's the way disruption works, right?
Right.
We all realized it, and we've written about it, we've talked about it, but we thought, basically, we said, we'll work it out. This is really cool stuff, and we'll work it out. And yeah, there's excesses here and there. What we didn't expect was this rise of populism, and not just the Trump victory, but across Europe.
Right.
Which is using the gaping holes in the system of trust and credibility to its own political ends.
Right.
And that is changing our world. We didn't expect that. And now we're all reeling from it. We're trying to figure it out. And but in some senses, we understand that we made a big mistake. We don't even know quite what the mistake was, but in not creating the signals in the new media that worked in the old media, we made a mistake.
Well, right. Some of those signals that were simply, they weren't by design, they were barriers to entry. So if there are no barriers to entry, anything goes to some degree. You know,
they were both, right? They were both. They were both barriers to entry, but they did signal something. And when you have, masses of people that believe things that are simply not factual, that's a big problem.
Well, yes, it certainly is. I mean, you know, skipping around a little bit here now, I wanted to know, what about net neutrality?
Similar there, that the idea of tiering and how we tier content and favor content, both with companies like Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T, essentially the pipes companies, the old distributors, that now all want to be media companies and to some degree have become media companies, their ability to favor their own content, their ability to strike deals that are in their interests of profit, but not in the interests of public discourse. I, of course, fear that that is going to be lost in the wash of saying, let's get on to the future.
I mean, with the cross ownership, I see the fig leaf of why you could say it's a good thing. With net neutrality, I don't see how you could tart that up to be in the public good. What's the blind? How will they do that?
I think it will be on the basis of investment, that usually if you look at the power of these companies that are now, that they've all consolidated in the last 2 to 3 years, and what they will all say, and what they've said in each of the hearings, same thing with Time Warner and Charter more recently, is, look, to do this stuff, to deliver this stuff, it takes incredible network infrastructure. And if you limit our ability to price and to grow markets, we can't make the investment. And we don't want the United States to fall behind.
The specter
of Asia, right? Asia is going to... Already, we're hearing, you know, that China is the big boogeyman in the world now, and Russia is our friend. Mm. It's those Asians. We're going to fall behind the Asians. So we got to unleash the power through investment and get rid of the regulation. It's really simple. I could do the testimony.
Well, I mean, but then what you have is you're going to have huge advantage for the legacy companies, just profound advantage there. So then at that point, there is the people who are looking to disrupt or the new entrants are really stuck. Yeah?
Yeah, they are stuck. And so then they get bought up. I mean, remember that NBCU, for instance, has put money, $400 million into BuzzFeed, $200 million into Vox.
Yeah.
NBCU is owned by, and it's a good company, an interesting company, has a lot of good people in it. Who owns that? Comcast.
Right.
So these companies, to the degree that, I mean, they're favored because they already have a big uncle there. Right. And either you have an uncle or you go under. There's really not that many of these companies anyways, when you look at it.
No, that's true.
So that's a problem. It's a bit, the problems and all kind of connect to each other. And I mean, it brings us back in American history to really Teddy Roosevelt.
Well, you have monopolies and monosopies, really. I mean,
yeah, exactly. And that's a problem. And it has been a problem before in America. And we'll see, you know, we'll see what the political will is to both understand it and deal with it.
Right. Well, I think there what will be interesting is you do have the populism, and that is sometimes a mad dog, which can sometimes not behave on the lead, if you will. So it will be interesting to see how that plays out. Let's talk a little bit about linear TV. And there's that sort of Mark Twain quote, I think, the report of my death was an exaggeration. It seems to me, I'm constantly reading articles that linear TV, commercial TV is dead. And then others say it's not dead. It's stronger than ever. I mean, as you said, you're going to have digital ads are just outstripping, you know, television ads. But then you have, you know, the CMO of Coca-Cola saying, it's all going to, you know, it's much more effective to be on television, back and forth, back and forth. What is your take on linear traditional television?
So I think you've named a number of the factors in there, and you can take a company that's kind of in between these worlds. There's this company, Simulmedia, for instance.
Oh, yes, we talked to Michael Zimblist, actually, if you will.
Oh, that's right, you did, didn't you? That's right, just on the 14th, that's right. And so, you know, and Dave Morgan started that company. He's a veteran of digital advertising. I knew him from the newspaper world long ago. And so that's that blend, right? It is saying, oh, people watch TV, but if you can target advertising using digital techniques that we've had for a long time, you can bring the digital targeting value of advertising to essentially linear TV. So there's a lot of in between here. Uh-huh. I think it is one of these things. Clearly, we're moving to an on-demand world. And I did a series on podcasting in the early fall, and that was really interesting. It was out of my immediate knowledge area, and I ended up doing three times as many interviews to understand it. But this digital on-demand world is changing. Is changing what we expect. Right. Now, I think in terms of linear TV, this idea of making watching TV, digital TV, digital on-demand TV, as easy as turning on the TV set is going to be where it's at. Now, we're close to that, but we're still two or three steps away from it. So it's all friction. We are very impatient people. I mean, it's incredible what we now expect. So we, 4 years ago, if there was a forward arrow on a video, if you touched it two out of three times, it would work pretty smoothly. And another time, it just wouldn't work. Now it works. And we expect it to work. And we are mad if it doesn't. Those two or three steps to be able to watch something on a living room monitor as easily as we can on a laptop are almost in place. In 2017, probably not, probably sometime between 2018 and 2020. And it looks to me like it's going to be voice activated, which is another whole revolution. But as soon as it is as simple to put on a program by your voice, which as opposed to going to a old-fashioned channel guide on a Comcast or a Charter, I think then that's going to be a big toggle in terms of moving to on-demand.
Right. What about the fact that a lot of the over-the-top players are these walled gardens, and because data is their currency, they don't necessarily want to share or be part of a one-stop experience. You know, it's their the barrier to the experience which all of the users want. It's part of what drives piracy. People are going for an experience, you know? They want to go one place. So what will trigger the change, do you think? What will get us that final step? What will convince the players? Will they be bought and consolidated? Or what would make that happen? Like how
it is. I mean, I think by the history we've seen in other trades, it's basically two things. It is it is consolidation and aggregation. So certainly consolidation, as in all of these fields, you have a number of people with similar ideas. They rise. You have market shakeups. Let's note here early in 2017 that a recession is coming sometime, and that all the problems of the consumer media world will get worse when that happens. And so that's going to force one consolidation. Mm-hmm. And the other one is just aggregation. So yes, a number of walled gardens, but even today through my Roku player, voice activated, I can look into, I think it's 9 walled gardens, simply by asking the question of Roku about a specific program. Huh. So I care about paying Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime separately? Well, I don't really like it, but I get enough service out of them. And as long as I can get to their stuff easily, and I can get there pretty easily today, I know I'm a fairly early adopter in that, but I think that's why I'm saying 2018, 2020, when we can all do that, yeah, there'll be fewer players, and the four players still to watch are companies we identified a few years ago as GAFA, you know, Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Apple.
Right.
And those players have tremendous capacity to either buy up or partner wherever they need to partner. To be the media companies, both for and with advertising and consumer revenue models, into the 2020s.
You think Apple's still going to be a force? That it's not misstepping?
Well, it is, but
just not sufficiently.
Right, not sufficiently. When you look at how much money they have, you know, they got, you know, the EU says to them, you know, you owe us. I'm trying to remember what was it, some number of billions of dollars in taxes, and they say, yeah. We don't like that and we'll appeal it, but, you know, we'll send you a check. You know? And right. So the fact that they really hadn't misstepped for so long is incredible.
Right.
And even Google. I mean, Google's certainly not in trouble as a company, but they are looking long and hard at Facebook and how Facebook is taking business away from them. So there will be stumbles of all of these companies just in terms of their sheer size, their consumer connection, the number of minutes that we spend with them every day. They have relatively more staying power than everybody else.
Right. Well, I've used up my half hour and then some with you, but thanks so much. Take care.
Oh, yeah. Great conversation. Bye.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who've helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, Ken Doctor, and of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.